it for 1 year before finally cutting back on some of its commitments under the deal. Later on, with the administration of Joe Biden sweeping into power and the White House's declared willingness to return to the negotiating table, Tehran and the remaining signatories went back to the Austrian capital with an agenda to revive the landmark accord. Initially, some progress was made, but long-running issues remain unresolved to this day. In the meantime, the U.S. continues to keep the sanctions in place as a tool of pressure against Iran. Now, with the possibility of a renewed push for the revival of the deal, Tehran says it will not settle for anything less than results that would safeguard the rights of its people.
Iran is a country of dialogue and negotiation. But a negotiation that guarantees the rights of Iranian people and forces all parties to return to their commitments.
Iran has been second to one point, but Washington was the party to violate the deal and should therefore be the party to take the first step by returning to full compliance. Tehran says it will start resuming its commitment only after the complete removal of all U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner. Action and not words. That's what Iran is demanding. It also says the European partners likewise need to put aside their empty promises and get back to action.
It was the inaction of the European states that emboldened Trump to withdraw from all agreements and violate the JCPOA and Resolution 2231. That happened because the European capitals all acted as only passive observers. We are expecting that all sides come to Vienna with the full understanding that there is no shying away from their commitments, which should be fully implemented under the accord.
Iran is seeking reassurances from the European signatories that such violations would never happen again. It says any renegotiation of the terms of the deal is out of question. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi is reviewing the details of the previous six rounds of discussions held in Vienna. Now, with speculations on the possible resumption of talks in the coming days and Tehran's firm stance, one can only speculate about how the other parties will fare up.
Food experts in Britain have been advising shoppers to buy Christmas dinner months in advance or they might go without, leading to a surge in sales. Demand for turkey has gone up 400% in recent days, and even toy shops are warning their shelves might be empty soon.
With the pandemic easing, Brexit is back in the news, with shortages of food, fuel and labour taking their toll. And this is bad news for the Conservatives, who promised to get Brexit done.
Under pressure, the government has now been forced to relax immigration rules and start issuing emergency six-month visas for thousands of butchers, poultry workers and HGV drivers to save Christmas and prevent 100,000 animals from being culled. Nonetheless, Prime Minister Boris Johnson insists there is no supply chain crisis, calling the current situation a symptom of an economy in revival.
I hate to be rude about politicians, but I have to say the Prime Minister in this case does appear to be somewhat deluded. Of course, the United Kingdom economy does have some serious supply chain issues. Mind you, so does much of the rest of the world. You only have to look at the issues relating to shipping and such like. Britain has made itself in a more difficult position by adding the phenomena that is Brexit, which has had added further complications and costs and reduction in the workforce coming from the largest trading bloc in the world, coming into the United Kingdom, and the UK economy is suffering because of it.
For decades, EU nationals have done labour-intensive work on British farms. Labour farmers say British workers just won't do. And the fact is it will take years to train enough Brits to drive heavy goods vehicles. So it might not just be a winter of discontent lying ahead for Britain, but years of adjustment. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has launched massive maneuvers in different locations across the country, including Isfahan, Bushehr, Bandar Abbas, Dizful, and Tabriz. The main operational phase of the large-scale drills, codenamed Fadaiyan Harim Velayat 10, began on Thursday with the participation of manned aircraft and drones. In the first phase of the military drill, aerial targets were shot at different speed and heights. Targets were hit on the ground under different conditions with the use of homemade upgraded heavy and semi-heavy bombs. During this military drill, different types of laser and radar missiles, as well as types of rockets and bombs made by young Iranian specialists, have been used. This is the first time that all the air bases of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran are jointly taking part in the military maneuvers, all in their own cities, but being commanded and controlled from the main command center in Tehran.
We used to hold military exercises in one particular location, but this military drill is being conducted at different locations across the country, and they're being commanded and controlled from the command center in Tehran. All the developments can be seen online by commanders at the headquarters, and so far all the operations have been carried out successfully.
Tens of different types of fighter jets, bombers, cargo planes, reconnaissance planes, and drones have taken part in the military drill. Moreover, Camon 12 drone has successfully destroyed specific targets using smart bombs. At the same time, Karar drones, which have been equipped with 500-pound bombs and rockets, have been able to precisely hit the planned targets. Meanwhile, the manned aircraft of the Air Force of the Army, with the use of the most modern electronic war techniques, disrupted anti-air defense systems of the enemy, preparing the ground for drones to carry out their operations.
This is the first time that such military drill is being conducted all across the country. The main feature of this maneuver is a concentrated command for non-concentrated operations. All the missiles, rockets, and bombs which are being used in this military drill have been produced by Iranian specialists. We have used precision-guided Qaseed and Yasin bombs. Moreover, we have used our combat drones like Camon 12, which is able to strike its target from a distance of 10 to 15 kilometers.
This massive maneuver is aimed at using an integrated command and control network and supporting operational and intelligence systems in the integrated network of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In the drill, technology-based and digitalized equipment, weaponry, and systems have been used.
This military exercise shows that the Air Force of the Army is well prepared to protect the country's territorial integrity and has full control over the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Winter is coming, and from the looks of things, it will be a long, harsh, and very cold one. But at the same time, the world is in the midst of an unprecedented energy crisis with dire economic, social, and political ramifications. Brent crude has surged to a five-year high of over $80 per barrel, while gas prices are up over 500% year-on-year. The International Energy Agency says the global energy crunch is expected to boost oil demand by about 500,000 barrels a day. Analysts say the energy crisis is rooted in soaring demand as the economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic takes hold, and the production level has simply failed to keep up with demand. However, some immediate measures could easily resolve this crisis. One such fix would be the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran, which enjoys one of the largest hydrocarbon reserves in the world. The flow of Iranian oil into the global market, for example, would be vital in easing the crisis.
Until a couple of months ago, it was not very important for the world that Iran is under sanctions because supply exceeded demand. But the current trends in the global market may put pressure on consumer countries, Europeans and countries like India and China or U.S. allies, to push Washington to lift sanctions.
Iran has repeatedly underlined its ability to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage. Its oil minister recently said people in the United States and some European countries are paying the price for their leaders' unwise policies. Javad Oji stressed that Iran on several occasions displayed its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis, but U.S. sanctions are standing in the way. People in Lebanon, who have been facing gasoline and diesel shortages and electricity blackouts, bear witness that ways are found where there is mutual will.
Iran has recently been delivering shipments of fuel to energy-starved Lebanon, despite U.S. sanctions targeting both countries. That was achieved through the determination of both Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. Iran had also earlier dispatched fuel shipments all the way to Venezuela. Now, as millions of people around the globe are bracing for a hard and long winter, it's worthwhile to ask how much of the ordeal could be averted through a similar international resolve.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This discord is an imposed one. July 18th, 2015. Today, the world of Islam is facing many problems. Islam has placed great emphasis on the unity, unanimity, and brotherhood of Muslims. We can hold fast by the rope that Allah stretches out individually, but Islam does not advise this. And hold fast altogether by the rope which Allah stretches out for you. Holy Quran, chapter 3, verse 103. All of us should hold fast by this rope together. We should be together, despite all the emphasis. Today, we Muslims do not unfortunately obey this command of Islam. And as you can witness, this is the result. I want to ask all Muslims, particularly ulama, scholars, intellectuals, officials, politicians, and outstanding personalities in all Islamic countries, to see the treacherous hands of the enemies of the Islamic Ummah. This discord is not a natural one. Rather, it is imposed on and suggested to us. Muslims can naturally live together. Experience has shown that when the enemies temptations, deception, and malevolence do not enter the arena, they can live together. We have seen this in our own country. We have seen this in Iraq and other Islamic countries.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Who is the real enemy? January 9th, 2015. This is the responsibility of everyone. Today, all Muslims throughout the world should think about the Islamic Ummah and Islamic unity. If we think of the Islamic Ummah, the interests of our countries will be safeguarded as well. The interest of the enemy lies in separating us from one another. His interest lies in attacking one country and raising an army with the help of another country. His interest lies in this. We should not allow them to do this. Who is the enemy? The enemy is American capitalism and global arrogance, which is headed today by America and the Zionists. The Zionist government in occupied Palestine is part of the dangerous group and the deadly cancer which the Zionists have created in the world. We should stand up against them.
In the limelight. From the perspective of international humanitarian law, the Hague and the Geneva Conventions, it is clear that drones are indiscriminate weapons and therefore illegal because they contravene the two core rules of international humanitarian law. The distinction between military and civilian targets and the principle of proportionality. We now present you an article written jointly by Alfred de Zayas and Adriel Casunta. The piece is titled U.S. Drone Strikes, Errors, and the Cost in Human Life. The article has been published by the Asia Times. Please stay with us for more of Alfred de Zayas and Adriel Casunta's article. According to the initial reporting from U.S. officials, the 29th of August drone strike aimed at annihilating members of the terrorist group Daesh was described as a successful operation that destroyed a car filled with multiple suicide bombers, posing an imminent threat to U.S. occupation troops leaving Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover. The celebratory mood did not last long, though, as witness reports that emerged shortly after the incident in Kabul's Khawaja Burga neighborhood debunked the Pentagon's narrative by exposing the ugly truth. The casualties were not terrorist savages, but 10 innocent members of the Ahmadi family, including 7 children. After photographs showing victims right before their deaths had emerged and actual footage of their horror began circulating on social media, it became clear that the youngest victims were just 2 years old. Another one killed in the airstrike was a 36-year-old former Afghan serviceman, an employee of the charity organization Nutrition and Education International, identified as Zamarai Ahmadi. Although, because of the public pressure, the Pentagon was later forced to admit that the assassination of these civilians was a tragic mistake, and ex gratia condolence payments to the Ahmadi family have been raised during a recent online meeting between Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Colin Carr, and the founder and president of Nutrition and Education International, Dr. Stephen Wan. The accountability for similar actions remains the great unknown. According to Amal Ahmadi's 22-year-old nephew, Farshad Haydari, as of 18th of September, the United States had made no direct contact with the family of the victims. Farshad Haydari told Agence France-Presse news agency, "They must come here and apologize to us face to face." Furthermore, despite U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's recent assertions that the Pentagon will endeavor to learn from this horrible mistake, there is little hope that this is the case, bearing in mind that the similar incidents concerning killing large numbers of civilians in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria had already taken place in the past. According to numerous reports by the New York Times and the Reuters news agency and other media. As Nick McDonnell, author of a 2018 book titled The Bodies in Person, An Account of Civilian Casualties in American Wars, argues, in fact, the U.S. military has repeatedly suppressed information on civilian casualties. Nick McDonnell says the drone program is opaque, with extremely limited accountability for anyone involved. Bearing in mind that most of the U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan have taken place in rural areas, and the fact that there is a direct correlation between the intensity of airstrikes and the cries in the investigation of civilian deaths in their result, there is little hope for meaningful justice for the victims, apart from this isolated case. Public outrage depends on the attention that the mainstream media will pay to drone killings. From the perspective of international humanitarian law, the Hague and Geneva Conventions, it is clear that drones are indiscriminate weapons and therefore illegal, because they contravene the two core rules of international humanitarian law. The distinction between military and civilian targets and the principle of proportionality. Moreover, they entail serious violations of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the United States and all NATO countries are bound to observe. It is worth noting that the concluding observations of the United Nations Human Rights Committee following the examination of the U.S. fourth period report in 2014 condemned targeted killings using unmanned aerial vehicles or drones as contrary to Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. We can read in the document, "The committee is concerned about the lack of transparency regarding the criteria for drone strikes, including the legal justification for specific attacks, and the lack of accountability for the loss of life resulting from such attacks." The document said, "The committee remains concerned about the state party's very broad approach to definition and geographical scope of armed conflict, including the end of hostilities, unclear interpretation of what constitutes an imminent threat, who is a combatant or a civil or a civilian taking direct part in the hostilities, the unclear position on the nexus that should exist between any particular use of lethal force and any specific theater of hostilities, as well as the precautionary measures taken to avoid civilian casualties in practice." Similarly, in his 2010 report to the Human Rights Council, Professor Philip Alston denounced indiscriminate killings through drones and concluded that the rationale given for their use eviscerate the human rights law prohibition against the arbitrary deprivation of life. In addition, drone killing of anyone other than the target, family members or others in the vicinity, for example, would be an arbitrary deprivation of life under human rights law and could result in state responsibility and individual criminal liability. In 2014, Ben Emmerson, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism, issued a damning report condemning the accountability vacuum for civilian killings by drones. As a United Nations independent expert on international order, one of the authors of this article agreed with Philip Alston and Ben Emmerson and decried the institutional impunity of the United States and North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, insisting that there is state responsibility, both civilian and penal, and an obligation by those states causing collateral damage to make reparations to the victims and their families. Unfortunately, although empirical evidence demonstrates the incompatibility of the use of drones with international law, the United States will continue ignoring the Human Rights Committee and the Special Rapporteur of the Human Rights Council because they lack enforcement mechanisms. It seems that drones will continue to be used with impunity until the international community agrees to exercise universal jurisdiction over war criminals, arrest them when they enter their jurisdiction, and thus vindicate the rights of the victims of such savagery. Above all else, the question remains, what is the right amount of money that can make up for the loss of innocent life? The mainstream media would be well advised to cease whitewashing these crimes, playing down the human cost of drones and disseminating disinformation about a supposed legal black hole. The priority must always be to provide immediate assistance, and not just money, to the victims and ensure that the new prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and expeditiously investigates these crimes.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat-3B, and IranSat, or BAT-5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has spoken to Muslims from around the world in conjunction with the Unity Conference held in Iran. The conference is held each year during the week of the birth of Islam's Prophet Muhammad. Given two possible dates of his birth, one date is believed by Sunni Muslims and the other believed by Shia Muslims to be the birth anniversary. These two dates was the week that Imam Khomeini, the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, used to name as Unity Week. And unity continues to be the main theme talked about by the leader of the way to true liberation for Muslims.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution addressed Iranian officials and foreign participants at an annual international conference on Islamic unity in Tehran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei highlighted the importance of unity in the Muslim world and said Palestine serves as a top criteria in this regard. Iran's leader also spoke about the US-backed agreements that several Arab countries clinched with Israel last year to normalize relations with the regime. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the US is trying to sow discord among Muslims by raising the issue of Sunni and Shia. Iran's leader spoke about what he called US pawns trying to sow discord wherever they can in the Islamic world. He said the most recent example is the tragic bombings targeting two Shia mosques in Afghanistan. Those attacks left scores dead in the cities of Kunduz and Kandahar. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Islamic countries to set aside their differences. He stressed that the unity of Muslims is a matter of principle which will strengthen them in interacting with non-Islamic countries.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Zafar Bangash, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto. And Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us on this spotlight. Well, let me start it off in Toronto with Zafar. Zafar, from the very beginning of the revolution in Iran, the leadership has continued to stress the importance of unity between the Muslims. How significant is it that unity has always been stressed by the leaders of the Islamic Revolution, even from the very beginning?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. First of all, I would like to congratulate all the Muslims around the world on the birthday of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, as well as the birthday of Imam Jafar As-Sadiq alayhi salam.
Congratulations to you too.
This is a very, very important occasion at which we must talk about Muslim unity, because if we look at the seerah of the noble messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wasallam, we see that among his companions were such illustrious people as Bilal ibn Rabah, Salman al-Farsi, Suhaib al-Rumi. These were non-Arabs, and yet they were some of the closest companions of the noble messenger of Allah. Secondly, when the Muslims migrated from Makkah to Medina, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam established a bond of brotherhood between the Muhajireen and the Ansar in Medina. And so it was this bond of brotherhood, and of course sisterhood for sisters, that created such a powerful force that Muslims were able to overcome the many challenges that they were facing. Now, if we look at the situation in the Muslim world today, regrettably, Muslims are divided at different levels. Although I would like to emphasize that at the level of the masses, the Muslims are united. And this is manifested in the Muslims' instant response, for instance, to the suffering of the Palestinian people or the suffering of the people in Yemen or Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan or the Rohingya refugees, etc., or Muslims suffering in Nigeria, that Muslims sympathy with these oppressed Muslims. But when we look at the level of the regimes or the governments, regrettably, some governments, for their own reasons, are not only not in support of the Muslims' struggles, but they actively conspire with the enemies of Islam, as we witness among some Arab regimes aligning themselves with the Zionist occupiers of Palestine.
Okay, well, Zafar, so I'm going to get into this in other parts. I'm going to break this down a little bit more throughout the program. Let me just get Said Mohsen involved in this conversation. Sorry to interrupt you, but Mohsen, isn't this part of the problem that certain Western countries have in general with Iran? Because the West's technique is to divide and conquer. And Iran, the Islamic Republic, has continually talked about the need for Muslims to be united, and also with other oppressed in the world. Your take on that?
Yes, I think it's been very clear that the Anglo-Zionist Empire, in particular on the international stage, has sworn its enmity to the Islamic civilizational, replenishment that the Islamic Revolution in Iran heralded and signaled. And indeed, over its 40 or so years of existence, it has steadily moved forward in trying to reestablish really the dream. The prophetic dream was really of a society which lived genuinely in peace, in harmony, to create all of those things which any ordinary human being, any ordinary human civilized individual would require, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim. However, history and the people who've dominated history have tended to veer away from the prophetic dream. And in a way, what we see in Iran and what we see Ayatollah Khamenei representing is a revival of that dream, the opportunity for us to create a civilizational impact with an Islamic prophetic morality and ethics. This is what's at the heart of, I think, what Ayatollah Khamenei has been saying in his speech as well. And it strikes at the heart of neoliberal, neocon, Anglo-Zionist ideologies of greed, plunder, and manipulation, destruction, war, conflict. These are the gifts which largely secular imperial, Western imperialism has brought to the world, previously as colonialists, but latterly as imperialists using their proxies in the various countries. So Ayatollah Khamenei, to me, in the speech that he's given, is done something which he does consistently. He brings even the nation of Iran back to its senses to say, look, this revolution is not just about some opportunity for us to be as material as everybody else or to follow the West in terms of its kind of aspirations of a worldly order. There's something deeper here. And I think throughout his speech, if you study it in more detail, you'll see this push towards Muslim nations waking up to the prophetic dream and engaging with this really important set of tasks, which he says, one, are to explain and promote the comprehensiveness of Islam, and secondly, to strengthen the unity of Muslims in order to be able to do that so that others don't misinterpret this faith. This is what I think he was driving at with his message.
All right. Well, Zafar, Ayatollah Khamenei says that if the Muslim community is united, the situation of Palestine, it would be resolved. Your assessment of exactly what this means?
Well, with respect to Palestine, it is at the heart of the Muslims' existence because Palestine is holy land, and it also comprises the first Qibla of the Muslims, which is Masjid al-Aqsa, which is currently under Zionist occupation. And what we see is that the holy land of Palestine has been drenched in the blood of innocent people by the Zionist invaders that are hell-bent on ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, as well as they have clear designs on destroying Masjid al-Aqsa. And so we find that the Zionist enterprise basically is a colonial secular entity in the very heartland of Islam. And that is why this emphasis on the liberation of Palestine is so crucial, because it is at the heart of the very existence of the Muslims. And so in that sense, what the Rahbar Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, and he has said it in many of his speeches, he has emphasized the importance of the liberation of Palestine and of Masjid al-Aqsa so that Muslims can allow that land and the people over there of whatever faith to live in peace and harmony rather than the present situation, which is full of oppression, tyranny, bloodshed, imprisonment of innocent people, and killings.
Well, Said Mohsen, if Muslims had a united front now, fill in that blank for me, what could be accomplished?
Well, first of all, I think on a civilizational level, it would be a fact that we would impact virtually every aspect of this, the lives of human beings on this planet, because Islam is a comprehensive way of life. It's not a non-religion in the sense that other religions exist. It's a complete manual for life. And I think that certainly in the vision of the core of the Islamic revolution and Ayatollah Khamenei himself, you know, the idea of Islam or Muslims being able to manage society, you know, to be able to distribute power and wealth equally, you know, more fairly, with more parity, you know, to resolve the war and peace issues with the akhlaq of the Prophet, the characteristics and the mannerisms of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the way he did in his own lifetime, you know, domestic and foreign policies of nations, areas in which, you know, the Anglo-Zionists or the forces with hatred for Islam have long tried to persuade the general masses that Islam is not capable of having a say in these things, are all being shattered, because the Islamic Republic of Iran has the only leader that I know that has an Islamic, a clear-cut Islamic ruler, somebody who is a jurisprudent, who is qualified in all of the laws and the legal aspects of Islam, but at the same time understands the secular reality. So establishment of justice through that divine, if you like, manual, that is represented by the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet, who was the beacon of light who launched this new civilizational vision and dream, which even Muslims, to be honest, haven't really taken full advantage of. And finally, to be able to fight oppression in the full sense of the word, not just pretend, because those who dominated the world and the globe over the last 300-400 years from the West have pretended that they're fighting oppression, they stand for morals and values. Mm-hmm. The reality of the ground was that they plundered and raped and pillaged and took resources from the poor and strengthened themselves. Islam would have to turn all of that on its head.
Well, Zafar, you heard Said Mosni talk about fighting oppression. I mean, and from the time we go to the Israeli regime that was created by the British in Palestine, some Arab governments were actually very active in trying to retake Palestinian land. What has happened that we went from Arabs declaring war against Israel because of stealing Palestinian land and killing Palestinians to now where we have four Arab nations openly establishing ties with Israel and other Muslim nations having ties, though not outwardly admitting to it? How did this happen?
Well, basically, what we are witnessing is that even in the past, there were these Arab regimes that pretended to be fighting against the Zionist occupiers, but in actual fact, their interest was not in the liberation of Palestine. They simply wanted to build their own image because they understood that their own masses are totally opposed to the Zionist entity. And at the present time, what we are witnessing is that these several Arab regimes have now come out openly in alliance with the Zionist occupiers of Palestine because these regimes have realized that America is on the verge of abandoning this region. It has suffered several defeats, as we witnessed, for instance, in Iraq, prior to that in Iran, in Syria, in Afghanistan. And so the American imperialists are now on the verge of abandoning this region as they go on to take on China, the new emerging superpower. And so its energies are going to be diverted in that direction. So these Arab regimes fear that with the American exit from the region, they will have no protective umbrella. And so they are now cozying up to the Zionist regime to provide them protection. I believe this is a false hope. These regimes are not going to benefit at all from their alliance with the Zionists. And in fact, it will cost them dearly. It will be better off if they were to reduce tensions in the region with Muslim countries. Regrettably, many of these Arab regimes are fighting each other, as well as the Islamic Republic of Iran. So if they were to make up with the Islamic Republic, as has been proposed by the Islamic Republic many times, that it would like to have good relations with all of these countries, I think the region would move towards stability. Mm-hmm. But at the present time, these people, these Arab regimes, are basically building sand castles that are likely to crumble very soon.
Said Mossad, Daesh and other terrorist groups, according to the leader, have been created and used against Muslim unity and Muslim lives. When we look at the plots initiated by those fighting against Islam, we see some very intricate ones, such as Daesh itself, which was created by the enemies of the Muslims, not only destroyed many Muslim lives and property, but at the same time, the terrorist group was able to demonize Muslims as being actually responsible for its creation. I mean, it just talks about the level, the degree that the enemy is going to destroy Islam. Your thoughts on that and what to do as a Muslim ummah to try to deal with that?
Well, we have to understand that billions and billions of dollars are put, first of all, into think tanks that evolve and develop these strategies. What the Anglo-Zionist Empire does, it doesn't do it overnight. It has a long-term set plan, something which it works towards, perhaps even on a 70 to 80 year cycle. We're currently going through that kind of a cycle in terms of what the global money mafia are doing, the Anglo-Zionist money mafia in the background are doing, and that we see in the shape of the global reset, the great reset that we're seeing being rolled out at the moment. And this is making way for the use of things like nanotechnology, you know, the bio weapons, bioengineering, AI, infotechnology, you know, these are all new facets which are at the disposal of a very evil, nasty set of folk who've shown their teeth to us over the last 100 years, particularly in the Muslim world, and they're now mapping out the next 100 years as to how they're going to really exploit humanity on a on a new level, a level we've never seen before. Now, how does this relate to the Islamic Revolution? Well, Muslims have a moral responsibility as the khalifas on this earth, according to the Quran, as the protectors, as the guardians, as those who are meant to look after this planet, to make sure that there is a balance, a mizan, a kind of an equitably run planet, which not only suits Muslims, but suits, of course, the brothers in humanity, and of course, the animal world, and beyond that. You see, Islam is not restricted, as Imam Khamenei said, to the arenas of the heart or to the arenas of private ritual worship. Islam came as a mercy to the world. The Prophet came as a mercy to the world. The Muslims need to gather their energies to reclaim that role. And this is where Ayatollah Khamenei and the Islamic Revolution is trying to urge the Muslim world to head towards. Because at the moment, the non-Muslim world can't understand us because they're brainwashed by propaganda by the Anglo-Zionists. They have a multi-million dollar industry that works night and day to subvert Islam, to create controlled opposition, to buy up proxies, to create color revolutions, everything to confuse even the Western masses from what Islam really is about. And they've achieved it very, very well, because the atheism that exists largely now in the Western world has a sort of hatred of religion per se, let alone Islam. So we've got our work cut out in terms of representing what Islam can do. And I think that can only happen once you can win back your own home territory. If you have your own arenas where you can prove that you can build institutions, you can build progress for humanity, you can show the kindness, the humanity, the love that the Prophet showed, and set a civilizational model that others can look up to, then it's game on. At the moment, I think that's what Islamic Revolution and what the Islamic Republic is trying to urge other Muslims to engage in.
And on that note, I would love to continue discussing this with both of you, but unfortunately, we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me out of Toronto. Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash. Out of London, journalist and political commentator, Syed Mohsen Abbas. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much, and hope to see you right here next time on another Spotlight.